Professor Barnett says, start, and I'm just here to follow orders. The great thing about the United States is not federalism. The great thing about America is it's a free country. Everybody is entitled to his own federalism. You've heard four views on the preceding panel. You'll now hear two more. In your packs, there are speaker biographies. The panelists on this installment here are so prominent, they need no introduction. Randy Barnett and Jesse Chopra. I can't remember. Did we have an arrangement who goes first?
Jesse just asked me that. Jesse said he wanted me to go first, so I always do what Jesse wants.
We will go in alphabetical order, and that is an order. Randy, please.
Well, first of all, thanks to AAI and the Federal Society for inviting me to this very interesting conference. I have to say I was so impressed by the substance of the first panel that I'm feeling a little bit intimidated about contributing anything after that panel. That was an unusually substantive panel for an academic conference of any kind. So I really enjoyed that. I thought what I would do in my talk, although this is a talk about the future of federalism, this is also a panel that's been devoted to the idea of the judiciary and the judicial role in enforcing federalism. And that means discussion of constitutional doctrine, which Malcolm has to do with the United States constitutional doctrine. So I will be talking about that as opposed to the European Union's constitutional doctrine. What I want to talk about is the past as a prelude to the future, because one of the things that's frustrated me about discussions of federalism in pretty much all the circles I run in is that it's so amorphous that people don't really clarify what they mean by federalism. And I think the reason for that is that there really are multiple meanings of federalism doctrinally in the United States, and they get run together. I particularly had that problem when we were doing our brief writing in the Raich case, which the organizers of this program graciously included the Supreme Court opinion in your packet. I think that was just to annoy me or to pain me or whatever, but if you want to read the wisdom of the Supreme Court, it's there for you to read. The problem I had when I was brief writing in there is because they kept referring, my co-counsels kept referring to the federalism parts of our opinion or the federalism argument. I couldn't keep straight which part of our arguments were the federalism parts of our arguments. We had enumerated powers arguments. We had some states' sovereignty or state autonomy arguments. And I couldn't figure out sometimes when they were just chatting about which were the federalism arguments, which ones they were. And in a way, the talk that I'm giving today, which grows out of a talk I gave at Loyola and which was published in the Loyola Law Review, you have in your packets an earlier version of that talk, not the published version. This three federalisms idea grows out of my experience in the Raich case with this amorphous concept of federalism, because I think in the history of our country we have had not one but three distinct notions of federalism, doctrines of federalism, and we, in discussing federalism, and particularly in the constitutional sense, have to keep these three notions distinct. So let me just go through the three of them and talk a little bit about them, and then after that I'll turn it over. And I'm going to be somewhat descriptive here, and then I think in the course of our conversation I'm going to get a little bit more normative about what ought to be in the future. Although I probably can't resist getting normative now. So let me talk about the first one. The first one that came first at the time of the founding was what I would call enumerated powers federalism. And it was a very simple idea. I mean, first of all of these ideas will be familiar to you. The contribution of this talk is simply to identify them as distinct notions of federalism that you have to keep straight when you're talking about it. That's all. So none of this is going to be new. In that sense, enumerated powers federalism is a theory of federalism that basically allocates power between the state and federal governments by means of the enumeration of federal power. That's how it's done. States have all the power left over after there's been power enumerated to the federal government. That was the original theory of federalism. Now, whether that is a good theory or a bad theory is a separate question. I think it has some strengths to it. I'm a proponent of enumerated powers federalism as qualified in the ways that I'm going to talk about in a moment. But it has its downsides. It has its serious downsides. And the most obvious one goes to the reason, one of the principal reasons why we had a doctrine of enumerated powers federalism, and that is to reserve a tremendous amount of power to the states. Everything left over is reserved to the states. Now, what was the reason for that? Well, there are lots of reasons for that, but one of the principal reasons for that is to ensure that states may maintain the institution of slavery. Now, if you're going to have a theory of federalism that's powerful enough or gives states enough power to maintain the institution of slavery, states are going to have a whole heck of a lot of power, enough power to enslave parts of their citizenry or parts of their population. Citizenry is a little bit anachronistic in this context. So that's a lot of power, and that's what the original enumerated powers federalism was in part, not entirely, but in part intended to accomplish. The other part it was intended to accomplish is something Ilya mentioned earlier, and that is to eliminate trade barriers by allocating the enumerated powers to the federal government in order to give the federal authorities enough power to eliminate some of the trade barriers that was taking place at the state level. Sure, that was another thing. They were trying to do a lot of things, not just one thing. So the important thing here isn't that they were trying to only do one thing, but whatever they were trying to do, they wanted to leave states enough power so that they can maintain the institution of slavery. Okay, so that's enumerated powers federalism. I have no interest in defending enumerated powers federalism as a constitutional doctrine by itself. I don't have to. It's not the Constitution we have today. The Constitution we have today was modified, somewhat radically modified, by the Reconstruction Amendments, by the 13th and 14th Amendments. The 13th Amendment specifically, as you know, took slavery off the table. It said, okay, fine, states can do whatever they want. If you just had the 13th Amendment, states can do whatever they want, but they can't enslave their own people. That's the one thing they can't do. In fact, under the 13th Amendment, nobody can enslave anybody. It's one of the only provisions of the Constitution that is not aimed solely at government. It's aimed at anybody. Slavery shall not exist, period, in the United States. So that was a substantial qualification, but it was a pretty narrow one. What had happened immediately after that? Well, you all know what happened immediately after that was that the states, who had a strong interest in slavery and a strong interest in perpetuating the badges and incidents of slavery under other names, became very creative about using all the other virtually unlimited powers they had under enumerated powers federalism to essentially re-enslave the population that had been emancipated. This was considered to be a problem with federalism, and it was a problem that was addressed by the 39th Congress when they wrote the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was a radical alteration of our system of federalism and represented a separate, a new, a distinct vision of federalism, which in this paper I call fundamental rights federalism. Fundamental rights federalism was a qualification of the earlier enumerated powers federalism. It did not eliminate the enumerated powers federalism. It combined with it. It said states may do anything they like states have all the powers that are left over after the enumeration of powers to the federal government, but they may not violate the rights of their own people. They may not violate the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So they may not make laws that violate the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, and in the application of those laws to particular persons, they have to provide a due process of law. That is, in applying these laws that don't violate privileges and immunities to particular persons, they have to do so accurately and fairly. Due process. And when it comes to enforcing the laws, they have to enforce these laws equally. And when it comes to the protection of the laws, so that you have a general law against murder, but some people in the community are being murdered and the sheriff's looking the other way. No, equal protection means everyone gains the equal protection of the laws that otherwise don't violate privileges and immunities, at least on their face. So what was put into place was a radical restructuring of federalism. States still had all this discretionary power, but they had side constraints on how they could be exercised so that they couldn't violate fundamental rights. Why? Because states could be an engine of tyranny. What kind of tyranny might states be an engine of? Slavery. That's tyranny. That is the ultimate tyranny, and that's what American states were practicing. Some of them were. Some of them weren't. All right, so now we have a new vision of federalism. Now, the vision of federalism says that the federal government, in the form of the Congress, because Congress is specifically authorized to do this, and also the courts, because that's what constitutional constraints allow, is the empowerment of the courts to also step in, that the Congress and the courts could both protect fundamental rights from abuses by states. Now, that is a major change in our theory of federalism. Now, and I think an important one. And the Constitution that I would defend, the original Constitution that I would defend on originalist grounds as being worthy of adherence, is the Constitution as amended by the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments and not the original Constitution. But what happened? Well, what happened is that both of these strategies of federalism, both the enumerated powers federalism and its as modified by fundamental rights, the fundamental rights version of it, they all consisted of what Madison referred to as parchment barriers. And by parchment barriers meant they were written down on paper, and it was expected or was hoped that the judicial branches would enforce these barriers, but Madison was very skeptical about the efficacy of parchment barriers because his experience and other experience of others like him was that courts really did not do very much to protect these rights that are put down on paper. And that's why he invested so much time in his structural protections of individual liberty as well as government power and all the other things that the structure of the United States Constitution provides. But it's because he was skeptical of parchment barriers. Well, the problem with these two doctrines of federalism in terms of maintaining their efficacy was they are basically parchment barriers, and they rely on judicial enforcement. So what happened? Well, we know the story. We all know the story of what happened. It's a long, interesting, complicated story. I can only allude to it here, just remind you of it. But obviously the first piece of the story happened 5 years after the enactment of the 14th Amendment, and that is the Slaughterhouse Cases was decided, which gutted the heart and soul of the 14th Amendment. I mean, after the Citizenship Clause, which is in some sense the heart and soul of the 14th Amendment, once you've gotten citizenship to everybody, then the heart and soul of what's left is the Privileges and Immunities Clause that says the states shall make no law that abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States. That was gutted, and if you go back and you read the Slaughterhouse Case, the 5-4 decision, that is the Slaughterhouse Cases, you'll see that the principal constitutional argument for gutting it is this is just too radical. That's the principal argument made in the majority opinion. It's too radical. In fact, it's so radical that we don't believe that this is what they meant to do because it's just too radical. We can't impute to them this intention to do something this radical. But it's exactly what the Republicans in the 39th Congress meant to do. They were radicals, they were influenced by radicals, they meant to be radical, and they were really disheartened. They were like kicked in the gut when 5 years later the Supreme Court just took out the principle, the flywheel of the 14th Amendment and eliminated it. So the first parchment barrier was gone. Now eventually the Supreme Court did come back and start expanding the two remaining parts of the machine, the Due Process Clause and Equal Protection Clause, to occupy some of the space that had been vacated by the excision of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. So the Due Process of Law Clause started to be applied to laws that violate fundamental rights, and the Equal Protection Clause started to be applied to laws that discriminate, which were both functions that were originally supposed to be performed by the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And that went along okay. In some sense, it started to move things back in the direction of what the 14th Amendment as a whole was supposed to do with respect to fundamental rights federalism. But then, as we all know, there was a change in the courts. And with the change in the courts, we had a new doctrine. And the new doctrine was this New Deal doctrine of judicial restraint, supposed judicial restraint, and allowing sort of an unlimited power in the federal government, or I think to put the way Jesse will put it, it's a power that's constrained only by political mechanisms. It's not going to be constrained by the judiciary. Now, the court never entirely adhered to this doctrine. In fact, it never entirely articulated this doctrine. It never entirely gave up scrutiny under the Due Process Clause and other devices, but as a practical matter, it did. And it did so gradually. So what ultimately happened was, as you know, is we had a virtually unlimited power of federal power given to the federal government under essentially the expansion of three clauses, or two clauses, but I say three clauses. The Commerce Clause combined with the Necessary and Proper Clause. It's really the Necessary and Proper Clause that does almost all the work in these New Deal cases and after New Deal cases. The Commerce Clause does very little work. The original meaning of the Commerce Clause was really not touched very much by the court, but the Necessary and Proper Clause was greatly expanded. And then the Spending Clause, which has already been, or the Spending Power, there is no Spending Clause. The power of government to spend tax money, which is not enumerated there, but which is really part of the Necessary and Proper Clause. And so along with the expansion of the Necessary and Proper Clause on the regulatory side came the expansion on the spending power side. It was the very same thing. So it's all in the Necessary and Proper Clause. That's how they did it. Now, what's the result of that? We have the result of that is a virtually unlimited power of the state. Now, what has been the response of the courts of the federal government? What's been the constitutional response of the courts to that? Well, it's had two parts. The first part, the earliest part to emerge, was the doctrine of fundamental rights. Not fundamental rights in the 14th Amendment sense of across-the-board fundamental rights of liberty, but specific, identifiable fundamental rights that the court in its wisdom would deem to be fundamental, rights that the court in its wisdom would deem to be fundamental and get special protection. And these rights included most of the Bill of Rights, most of the enumerated rights in the Bill of Rights, not including the Second Amendment until very recently. Alan Gura is in the room. Everybody give Alan Gura a big hand. Give Alan Gura a big hand. So that's part of the fundamental rights. And then they decided they would protect some unenumerated rights at their discretion, and like the right of privacy. That they deem to be fundamental. So essentially what you have here is a system of unlimited governmental power at the federal and state levels. I mean, in the sense that the federal government has the power, but so does the states. They all have their whatever powers the federal government lets them have, qualified by certain specific identifiable rights, the fundamental rights. So you have some qualification. Now, what happened next was the new federalism of the Rehnquist Court, which I don't have a real pithy name for, but for purposes of this talk, I call it affirmative state sovereignty federalism. And this affirmative state sovereignty federalism is really akin to the fundamental rights federalism. Fundamental rights federalism is a way of saying, okay, fine, there's certain privileged spheres or zones in which the state cannot intrude into your individual life. Affirmative state sovereignty federalism says, fine, we're going to concede the federal government has this virtually unlimited power under the Necessary and Proper Clause, but we understand that the implication of that is that we could just basically wipe out the states. And so in order to prevent that from happening, we're going to do for the states what we are sort of half-heartedly doing for individuals, and we're going to carve out certain individual judicially protected spheres or enclaves for state power. And that's the new federalism. Now, the new federalism, which is supposedly grounded in the 10th Amendment and the 11th Amendment, and we could go on to this more later, whether it really is or not, I think really it doesn't really reflect the original meaning of either of those two amendments. The court doesn't say that it does. In fact, the court does the same thing that the left wing of the court does, and that is they say it's based on the underlying principles of those amendments. The underlying principle of the 10th Amendment is federalism, the underlying or state sovereignty. The underlying principle of the 11th Amendment is state sovereignty. So we're going to protect state sovereignty directly. And that is the new federalism model, affirmative state sovereignty federalism. So is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? We're going to leave that to discussion. I'll just say this. In some sense, maybe it moves things back in the direction of what the overall structure of the Constitution, the original meaning of the Constitution says, as amended by the Reconstruction Amendments. And that might make it a good thing. But it's a bad thing in the same way that the Supreme Court's fundamental rights, individual rights doctrine is a bad thing, because it moves the court further and further away from the text of the Constitution as its guide on what both the rights of individuals should be, the rights retained by the people under the 9th Amendment, and also what the rights of states would be, and that is the rights reserved under the 10th Amendment as qualified by the Reconstruction Amendments, which put some federal constraints on state power.
Thank you, Randy. Malcolm. Sorry, Jesse.
Same place. All right. I want to say at the outset something that I've said each time I've spoken to a program run by the Federalist Society, and that is, and there have been quite a few of them, but I am not a member of the Federalist Society, but I really do admire the quality of the program, the quality and objectivity, and some real effort to rip apart questions from all points of view that are put on at these programs. It's always been a pleasure for me to participate in them. So, the title of this particular panel is Judicial Review of Federalism, and I want to echo Randy's comments about the really interesting, provocative, stimulating, complex discussion that we had in the beginning, first panel. What I want to emphasize is that there is, it seems to me, virtually nothing that we're going to talk about in respect to the question of judicial review and federalism and what went on at that first panel. Now, maybe I'll just leave it there for the time being. So what if you look at the introductory description of what this conference is how should we balance state and federal rights? That's what this is all about. And then there are two sets of questions. First, can we make better progress on these issues by allowing states to pursue their own policies independently, or should the federal government take a more active role? I have no strong judgment in respect to that question. I do favor limited national power. For example, in the Lopez case, the Gun-Free School Zones Act case, if some member of Congress had asked me, not that they ever do, is this constitutional? Should I vote for this? Is this within national power? I'd have said probably not. Nonetheless, this leads us to the second issue, and that is, should the courts take a more active role in limiting federal power, or should they instead leave the federal state agenda to the political process? On that, I have a strong view. Although I've already indicated that the Gun-Free School Zones Act was bad constitutional policy, I thought that the Lopez ruling was an inappropriate exercise of judicial review. So let me move on to that. See some frowns. How could that be? Well, it could be. 31 years ago, that's scary. I must have been 14, 15 years old. I took the position that the court should not decide constitutional questions in respect to the power of the national government vis-a-vis the states, that it should be treated as non-justiciable. I deliberately avoided the use of the phrase political question at that time, although that's exactly what I meant. But I didn't think it. I thought it would divert people's thinking, and just called it non-justiciable. I did not urge this as a matter of original intent. Not that I'm unsympathetic to looking to basic original understanding, but to the extent that I looked, it seemed to me to be unclear. I always had some real questions as to the original understanding in respect to the whole exercise of judicial review. If there's much to be said for it, there's also much to be said against it. This is the subtitle of the book I wrote was A Functional Reconsideration of the Role of the Supreme Court. So what is the rationale for saying that issues of national power versus states' rights should be held to be, political questions? Well, first of all, as a matter of structure and process, I took the view then, and I still believe it quite strongly, that state interests are well represented. And, by the way, there's a nice issue, and I won't go into it, is how do you determine who articulates the interests of the states? But let's put that aside for the moment. That state interests are well represented and sympathetically considered in the national political process. The strongest evidence of that is the equal representation of the Senate, which I think the population figures probably still show that if you really lined up the 51 votes from the smallest states, or indeed 50 votes is all you need to stop at 50, the 25 smallest states cover not much more than 15% of the population of the country. And by the way, you have to have 51 votes in the Senate to get anything done in respect to the enactment of legislation. So that's number one. And I'm on the airplane today. I commend to you an article by Bradford Clark in the recent issue just came out of the Notre Dame Law Review, in which he really focuses hard on what the purpose of equal representation was. And that, you talked about the anti-federalists being anti, you know, unsympathetic to states' rights. Well, that was the price of getting him to go along. Okay, enough of that. We also, the state's interests are strongly represented in the House of Representatives. We have the biggest, California, have the biggest congressional delegation there. They caucus frequently to take positions on national legislation, and they're not there, you know, just to exchange personal views. It's from the standpoint of the state of California, and certainly in the executive branch as well. State interests are strongly represented there. I think the dynamic that you want to understand, and the most important part, is that laws that allegedly exceed national power and impinge on the territory of the states require very wide support through both houses of Congress and the executive branch before they're enacted. There is as we all know, there's an enormous inertia in the national lawmaking process, and that all works to protect states' rights from national intervention. Before a proposal becomes law in our national government, you got to go through a whole series of obstacles, beginning with the ability of committees to bury legislation, proposed legislation in some black hole. Lobbies, which are not unimportant in getting legislation enacted, are much more effective in stopping legislation from being enacted. The filibuster doesn't need, in the Senate, doesn't need any explanation. It's perfectly clear that you don't need 51 votes to pass a law today. You need, if the, you know, where the rubber hits the road, you need 60 votes, which is, I'm not a mathematician, but you can do the numbers. If 15% of the population is represented by 50, okay. And finally, the presidential veto really raises the ante to a very substantial degree. They all act as negatives. You know, there's a lot of talk, and I think wise talk, about the anti-majoritarian nature of the legislative process. But when it comes to determining whether or not the legislative process has abused states' rights, has moved into the sphere of state authority, whatever that is, it's taken an awful lot. Okay, so that's a matter of structure and process. Secondly, as a matter of substance, I think there's an important distinction, and I argue there's an important distinction, between states' rights and individual rights, which are the two of the three great divisions of power that we have under the Constitution. First of all, federalism is, it seems to me, very different because as a matter of it turns on a matter of practicality. After all, the major purpose of the second Constitution, if you will, after the Articles of Confederation, was to enable the national government to exercise power in respect to matters which the states, is a phrase someplace there, which the states were separately incompetent to deal with. This is a very practical, political, fact-oriented and fact-based issue, as opposed to the matter of individual rights, which do not get sympathetic consideration in the national political process. Indeed, the very purpose of the Bill of Rights and individual, and the few that existed in the original Constitution, was to say you can't do this even if you want to, that majorities are not going to be sympathetic take a look at the Bill of Rights. All, the great majority deal with the rights of those accused of crime. That's not a very politically powerful group, as a general proposition, or unpopular political and religious groups. So they're not there. What? When we hold something unconstitutional, it's not a matter of it's because they're impractical. It's just that our ideals, reflected in those provisions of the Constitution, prevail over the short-run efficiency of squashing those ideals. You know, the issue was certainly put, not easy to resolve, but when you see the question of national security versus individual rights. As a consequence, I think Congress is at least as good, or the political process, the politically accountable elements of the government are just as good or better than the Supreme Court in determining the question of what are problems in respect to which the states are separately incompetent to deal. And consequently, there's no need, in my judgment, for the Supreme Court to exercise this anti-majoritarian power of judicial review, an enormous power, and one that continues to create real tensions between representative democracy and the kind of rules of the Supreme Court, a quite anti-majoritarian agency. I won't go into that, hands down. And in addition to that, declining to exercise judicial review over these questions, which get questions of states' rights, federal power versus states' rights, which get a strong hearing in the national political process, preserves the court's political capital, if you will, which is easily dissipated. I've certainly seen that just in my time in areas where they're really needed. Because federalism issues, not only invalidations of congressional power, but validations of congressional power by the Supreme Court, which would be avoided if it were a political question, have gotten the court in lots of trouble. Lots of trouble over the years, beginning with McCulloch against Maryland. So, I want to talk just a couple more minutes about the scope of this notion, maybe anticipating some of the negative reactions that you've had so far to a proposal which ordinarily does not fly readily in this audience. It's a broad proposal. It applies not only to the regulation of the states qua states, but to private regulation of private persons within the states. That is that's the Gun-Free School Zones Act case, or the Violence Against Women Act case. And it applies to all exercises of national power. The spending power, the taxing power, the treaty power, executive agreements entered into by the president, which allegedly impinge on states' rights, all right? But, importantly, it does not apply to Supreme Court review of the validity of state regulations that allegedly interfere with national power. Why? Now, and this is the most prominent example is the Dormant Commerce Clause. Why? Because unlike the situation of state interests being powerfully represented in the national political process, national interests, nor the interests of out-of-state people, are not well represented in the state political process. We had some extensive discussion about that. I think that goes without saying. And secondly, for me at least of equal importance, is when the court strikes down, invalidates a state regulation because it it violates the Commerce Clause and the Dormant Commerce Clause, it is not an exercise of the power of judicial review. They have not held, they've held the state statute invalid, but their decision can be changed, which you also talked about the McCarran-Ferguson Act, by an ordinary act of Congress. So the court is not exercising the final word. It's really no different in structure than a statutory interpretation decision, and therefore doesn't apply to that. And I want to say the Supreme Court is not without strong influence over issues of national power versus states' rights under my theory. That is, there's nothing stopping the court from adopting a rule as it did in Gregory against Ashcroft, a requirement that before a federal statute will be interpreted as applying to various state functions, that you have to have what are they called, the plain statement rule or the clear intention rule. That, again, that can be changed by Congress, but, you know, you can put the congressional feet to the fire, if you will, under those circumstances. And I should say issues of statutory interpretation like that are, I don't want to say always, but almost always open to the Supreme Court, as it was in Ashcroft. They said Gregory against Ashcroft, involved the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, one that people like myself are quite sensitive to. It applies to everybody. The Supreme Court said, well, if it applies to judges, you better say so. That's a somewhat shorthand description of the court's rationale, but that's pretty much what it said. So 30 seconds more, may I? So the high watermark for this unconventional position, which was it should be non-justiciable, was at least in part adopted by the Supreme Court in the Garcia case in the middle 1980s, when the court upheld Congress's power to apply the Fair Labor Standards Act to state employees. But that was the high water mark, and that's now almost 25 years ago. I have every reason to believe that the current five-justice majority on the Supreme Court is unsympathetic to the decision in Garcia. I go so far as to say if the same five had been there, they wouldn't have decided it in that way. And they certainly are not about to extend Garcia, the current five justices, beyond where it applied. And that was a federal law that was a law of general applicability, included the states within the area of regulation. Whether if the five hang together in time to overrule Garcia is a different question, and involves very different considerations of stare decisis and where they're going to go. They certainly could have done it several times and declined to do so, but were still able to reach the result that they did in striking down the federal legislation, New York against the United States, Prince against the United States, in about 15 cases, that they've decided since then. The interesting thing is, when I wrote this in 1977, there was only one majority decision of the Supreme Court that had held an act of Congress beyond its power as violating states' rights, and that was the famous Ussery case, which was overruled in Garcia since 1935. That's an important qualification. There was only one since 1935 in which they did that. So in reality, what I was urging then was no change in practice or result, but a marked distinction in the rationale that they use for not overturning state legislation. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jesse. I've been tasked with moderating this panel, and I want to I'll give the panelists a chance to respond to each other more directly if they so choose, and then we'll leave ample time for questions from the audience and further discussions. Just to kick this off, I want to ask each panelist one question. Randy, it would be useful, I think, and instructive for the audience if you could talk a little bit about the Raich case in which which you handled yourself, because we would benefit from an insider's perspective. This is, you may recall, the case involving California's medical marijuana laws and the question whether the federal Substance Controlled Substances Act blocked or trumped. I take that back. My question about the case is the following. To your mind, was that a case of what you called enclave federalism or reserve powers federalism in the sense that much hangs on the fact that California had this medical marijuana statute? Or is it a case of, is it a straightforward, clean, pure, enumerated powers case to your mind? And related to that is a second question. When you describe the reserve powers or enclave federalism, are there elements in the Supreme Court's federalism that, to your mind, are more reminiscent of enumerated powers federalism as amended through the 14th Amendment and so forth? That's my question to Randy. And let me ask the question of Jesse as follows. I suspect there would be members in the audience who would be a whole lot more comfortable with your position if the Supreme Court extended its deference or standoffishness not only to conflicts between Congress and the states, but also to its own interventions in this area. It's one thing to say, sorry, states can represent themselves in the political process, and then to say, and one advantage of taking that position is we, the court, preserve our political capital. If you look back, what has the court invested that capital in? Answer, uniformly and consistently cases that, whatever you think of the underlying merits, severely constrain the authority and the ability of states to govern themselves and their own internal affairs. It's one thing to say we take a position of standoffishness and neutrality in the political process and representation will do what they will do. It's a very different thing, people might say, for the Supreme Court to be standoffish at one end and then sort of, right, take sides in an area that's ostensibly not about federalism but has these very profound and consistently adverse consequences for the states. So why don't we start on those questions?
I thought he was going to ask me to comment on where you would sit. You go ahead.
Okay. Okay.
Are you conspiring?
I said to Randy, why don't I answer first if we're supposed to comment on each other's? Because I can answer mine very, very easily. I agree with everything you said. I mean, it was a perfectly.
Well, Jesse said.
But he asked different questions.
Right. So Jesse said I should go first. Again, I do what Jesse tells me to do. You have this authority of a former dean, Jesse. The thing is, I don't obey my current deans, I only obey former deans. So,
all right with me.
To talk about the Raich case. I think the Raich case, first of all, in terms of what we argued in the Raich case, and for those of you who don't know the whole history of the case, I and two other lawyers brought suit to challenge the application of the Controlled Substance Act to two women in the state of California, Diane Monson and Angel Raich. And so it was not a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the Controlled Substance Act, but as a challenge to its constitutionality as applied to their situation. Diane Monson grew cannabis in her backyard to treat severe back pain and spasms that she suffered from, which were non-responsive to conventional pain relief. And Angel Raich suffers from a variety of ailments that result in a wasting syndrome, which she uses cannabis to resist. Cannabis is actually quite effective in that sort of thing. And, in fact, she had been wheelchair-bound prior to discovering the cannabis was effective in enabling her to maintain her strength and keep her weight on. She doesn't grow it herself, but she has caregivers that grow it for her at no cost to her. So no money is changing hands in either case. So we have challenge this the constitutionality of the Controlled Substance Act as applied to these women. We did make both enumerated powers federalism arguments and state sovereignty federalism arguments, and that's why I said I got confused when we had private discussions about which one was our federalism argument, because they both were, or neither was, or I wasn't sure which was which. Our state sovereignty federalism argument didn't go very far. I mean, no court at any level, including the Ninth Circuit, who ruled for us on the enumerated powers theory, was at all enamored with that idea for a variety of reasons. The Supremacy Clause loomed very large in the rejection of any notion that there was a traditional function of states in providing, for example, a regulation of medicine. The regulation of medicine is traditionally done by states. I mean, that's, you get a medical degree, you get a license to practice medicine from the state. You don't get it from the federal government. That's just been a traditional state function, and what the state of California was doing, along with 11 other states, I should say, was saying that in the practice of medicine, you can do this. You can use. It was a physician regulated administration of this particular substance under its law. It didn't call it a prescription because to call it a prescription would implicate federal law in certain sense. So the statute talks about a recommendation instead of a prescription, but a recommendation was necessary to legalize this use. Possession and use. So we made an argument like that. We made an argument like that in part to appeal to Justice Kennedy, who had written a state protective concurring opinion in Lopez. He did not buy into the enumerated powers arguments of the Chief Justice or the concurring opinion of Justice Thomas, which, by the way, in both Lopez and Morrison, Justice Scalia did not join, just to be clear, because there's still anybody out there that thinks these two justices are clones of each other. Justice Thomas had an enumerated powers argument in his concurring opinion, Lopez and Morrison, and Justice Scalia did not join those opinions. He joined the majority opinion by Justice Rehnquist, which left unchallenged the New Deal expansive notion of federal power. We had this argument in our briefs in order to appeal to Justice Kennedy. You see how far we got. For those of you who don't know the lineup, we lost 6-3, and we had votes from Justice O'Connor, Justice Thomas, and Chief Justice Rehnquist are the people who voted for us. If I tell some of my progressive friends that that's who voted for us, they who don't know much about, don't follow constitutional law, they are like astonished. They can't believe that's who voted for the medical marijuana people. But there's good reasons for us to understand why that's true. Anyway, what's really challenging is to you know tell them that all the good progressive justices voted against it. That's something that I like to bring up frequently. So. So that didn't go very far. The one that did, but I think it should have. I mean, if you're going to take this affirmative state sovereignty notion seriously, the regulation of medicine seems to be a traditional state function, and it's something that the federal government was interfering with their regulation of interstate commerce. And so, as applied to this situation, not that the federal government isn't perfectly free. Not that the federal government wasn't perfectly free to regulate interstate commerce in all of these substances. We never challenged that. No one's ever challenged that constitutionally, but only that, as applied to this state scheme, they were interfering with the operation of the state regulation of medicine. It should have gone far. It just didn't get anywhere. So what the case ended up being about, and the only thing that the court opined about, was the enumerated powers argument that we'd won on below. Because we didn't win on the state sovereignty argument, we did win on the enumerated powers argument. That's the only thing that the court dealt with. And to that argument, I think that this is a good illustration of why it is that judicially protected federalism is a boon for individual liberty. Now, that's something that Justice O'Connor has mentioned in her numerous federalism arguments, and it's something that critics of federalism, critics of those opinions, critics of her, have ridiculed, or at least they've disparaged. I mean, you know, how meaningful is it that federalism or enumerated powers federalism is a protection of individual liberty? Why would that be true? Well, I think our case illustrates why that's true. The only this is really my response to Jesse also. And I'm going to one response to Jesse, which I'm not going to do, is to kind of go through the political science considerations that the first panel did. I couldn't do it as well as the first panel did, but that you could go through all of those different situations. I'm just going to do a sort of just standard judicial protection of liberty idea. How does the enumerated powers protect liberty? Well, let's take the Gun-Free School Zone Act first, very quickly. The Gun-Free School Zone Act said that it was unconstitutional for the federal government to ban guns within 1,000 feet of a public school. That indirectly protected the individual right to keep and bear arms. you didn't have to litigate the individual right to keep and bear arms, but that's the effect that it had. So it had the limitation on federal power indirectly protected. It meant you didn't have to reach a claim about individual liberty because the individual liberty was being protected indirectly. Now, it is true that that same power, that same right, that liberty, under this enumerated powers idea, would be subject to state regulation. And, in fact, there are guns-free school zone acts in the states. So that's something you'd have to look to the 14th Amendment to deal with. So because we don't have a pure system of federalism, we have fundamental rights federalism in the Constitution. But the enumerated powers federalism would have had that effect in the gun-free – did have that effect in the gun-free school zone act case. Now, in our case, our case really illustrates the role – the close connection between individual personal liberty, including not only the liberty to use a particular substance to preserve – to ameliorate pain, but the liberty to preserve one's life. There are sections of this country who have a different opinion about the use of marijuana than other sections of this country have. And what the people who felt this way about the use of marijuana did was they organized in their states. Now, they couldn't get these bills passed by their own state legislatures, but what they did do is they used the referenda and initiative processes in these various states. So they organized politically in the states in order to protect their liberties. And essentially what the Raich case says, I mean, we can argue about what the real import of the Raich case is. I think it actually would have a very limited import if the court ever wanted to revive its federalism jurisprudence. It'll have a maximum import if they don't. But what the Raich case basically does is it overrides the ability of individuals to organize locally in order to protect their liberty. That's what it does. What Justice Breyer said to me in oral argument is, why don't you just go to the federal government and get your protection there? And the answer is, it's very difficult to do because it's as an individual. This is a response to Jesse's process-based argument, sort of the Ely-type process-based argument in favor of individual liberty. It's very difficult for an individual, particularly an individual who represents a minority constituency in the country as a whole, to go to the federal government and get this kind of protection. The federal regulatory process on this subject is completely rigged, totally rigged. That was my response to Justice Breyer in oral argument, just to have him read the briefs, which describes how rigged the process is, if that's the process you want to rely on. But it's been rigged. It's been rigged for political reasons because there is not a national constituency in favor of legalizing marijuana. It's a matter of debate. However, individuals have it within their power to organize locally, and that's what's happened in 11 states. And what the Raich case does is said, we don't care about that. So that's the enumerated powers part of it. What happened next, and this is I'll wrap up. What happened next was, of course, after we lost, we were remanded to the Ninth Circuit, and then we got to argue our due process clause argument, which we'd always argued, and which we hadn't, you know, had a ruling on, and we lost in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost because the court used the standard Glucksberg approach, which says that the only liberties that get protected are those that are deemed by the court to be fundamental, and the only ones that are deemed the court to be fundamental are those that are deeply rooted in the nation's tradition and history, and here's the critical, putting the rabbit in the hat, we will define the liberty in the narrowest, most specific way it can be defined. So we argued on remand that the liberty that was being jeopardized was the right of Angel Raich to preserve her life. Diane had dropped out of the case. We could focus on the right to life. We thought that was pretty fundamental. The government argued that the right at issue was the right to smoke marijuana for medical purposes. That's very narrow. Now, which one would you say is deeply rooted in the nation's tradition and history, and which one is not? And however you answer that question, here's the dirty little secret of constitutional law. Both formulations, both descriptions of the liberty are accurate. What was at stake in our case was both could equally well be described as the preservation of life on the one hand or smoking marijuana for medical purposes on the other hand. They're both accurate. So what the court's doctrine is you pick the most specific version of the accurate descriptions of the right, And once you pick the most specific version, you're going to find it's not deeply rooted in the nation's tradition and history. End of case. Case dismissed. That's exactly what happened to us. So that's the way it's done. That's the way the game is played. This way, liberty doesn't get protected at all. If the enumerated rights line had been held, you never would have had to get into any of this. And that's the advantage for individual liberty of restricting enumerated rights, enumerated powers. Sorry.
Jesse.
You got unlucky with the panel. I don't know who was there, but we won't go into that.
That's a very good question, Joe. Let me just say it was a 2-to-1 liberal panel. 2-to-1. I'm not going to name the justices, but there was a 2-to-1 liberal panel. But my view is, why did the liberals who ruled for us 2-to-1 on the Commerce Clause challenge not rule for us on the fundamental rights challenge? I think it's pretty clear. The reason is they predicted, and I think they predicted accurately, that the Supreme Court would reverse them if they ruled for us, having reversed us. And I think they're probably right about that. So if the job of the appellate court is to predict what the Supreme Court would do, they predicted probably correctly. And frankly, I was grateful, because it was painful enough to make bad law on the enumerated powers scheme. To have been the person to have brought a case to make bad law on two doctrines I care about would have just been too much to bear.
I think that the Raich case is really a good one to use as a platform for discussing the difference of views that we had. And I think I can include, because Randy did your discussion of the Supreme Court being very activist under my theory and protecting individual rights and being out of it so far as states' rights are concerned. Okay. Interestingly, we both disagree with what the court did in the Raich case. All right. Randy's already indicated why he disagreed. He thinks they came to the wrong conclusion on the merits. I disagree because they even reached the merits. He got 3 votes. I got none. So comparatively, at least, is a victory. I think the Raich case indicates the great weakness of the court's effort to revive the judicial protection of states' rights, which was sort of the signature issue of the Rehnquist court. It is perfectly clear to me that if you took seriously what they said, both in Lopez and Morrison, the Gun-Free School Zones Act case and the Violence Against Women Act case, that this was that growing your own marijuana, and this was homegrown marijuana to be used for medicinal purposes, which were the facts that you argued and stressed, no more than that, was not an economic or commercial transaction. And to the extent that the court gave us any guidance as to what is protected or what is beyond Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, this looked like it to me. Nonetheless, the elasticity of that standard was demonstrated in the Raich case. Indeed, as was pointed out, even Justice Scalia said, well, this is part of an interstate market, and therefore it can be regulated. Is that correct? Hard to see exactly what he was saying, but that he said this is marijuana is an interstate market. Well, so is the wheat in Wickard against Filburn, which he certainly didn't agree with. Now, he didn't give us an explanation for that. I'm not saying he could, because I don't think that there is any really manageable standard that they can use. They want to use something. They want to use what is somewhat more manageable is historically within the sovereign authority of the states, like education, right? But as you point out, this is medical treatment is historically regulated. So anyway, it shows the weakness of this notion. That's another reason I didn't burden you with that in the beginning, and that is they can't come up with any reasonable standard to determine what is left of the states. They can't carve out those notions or look at the end of the power. Okay, so then comes the issue, and I move on. The issue is, well, what about the notion that this is in many ways the strongest argument against my position. And that is that federalism, here I am saying, the court should be very active in protecting individual rights. I didn't say how active they ought to be in defining what they are, because I certainly don't want to say that I'm originalist, but because I think it's so difficult. But I am very sympathetic to what Randy also said in his paper about these very elastic standards giving the court the power to knock down anything they find to be a fundamental right. So the bottom line is that while I believe in aggressive enforcement of individual rights, I don't believe in substantive due process, except to the extent that they apply the Bill of Rights to the states, because there at least you have articulated rights and you have the thinking of the founders as to what they had in mind in protecting. Consequently, much as I was sympathetic to California's medical marijuana law, and you really had a sympathetic situation here, I don't think there's a constitutional right. Now, so you say, well, but federalism, therefore, look, it protects individual freedom. Well, it does in a way, but I don't think it protects individual constitutionally protected freedoms. It is you said it all. It's just we sort of differ at the jump off in the end. You said, well, Gun Free School Zones Act, it was a Second Amendment. They did avoid the Second Amendment issue, but it's a right that is not a constitutionally secured right unless the court says so. Maybe it has last term that the Second Amendment, although they don't say it applies to the states so far, and that would be necessary in the that's right. It wouldn't apply in the Texas case either. Texas had a Gun-Free School Zones Act of its own. You know, if you look at that Lopez case, it's really very interesting as to the way these things work. He was originally indicted under Texas law. Then they got rid of it. They cleaned off their docket. The feds came in. They said, you take it, which they did. And you said 28 states have such laws? Whatever, a bunch of them have laws against carrying guns near schools. But the fact is that this wouldn't have helped Mr. Lopez any, and it wouldn't have helped people in 28 states either, unless the court turns around and then says we have a constitutional right under the Second Amendment that applies to the states to carry the guns. Similarly, Raich case, I thought you had a strong argument on the end. Given the state of the doctrine of substantive due process, with which I disagree, and it also shows the malleability of that. You know, it's the difference. Justice Scalia tries to make it as narrow as possible, and the debate was carried on with Justice Brennan. Those initials, the cases, I forget the name of the case exactly, but H.R. against B.Z. or something like that, in which it was all done in a couple of footnotes, but they had this big debate over how you determine what our historically accepted practices are. It depends on, as you point out, how you characterize the practice. This had to do with parental rights, and Justice Scalia very narrowly, visitation rights, I think, of an illegitimate father of an illegitimate child, and Justice Brennan in dissent very broadly. That's the sort of discretion I don't like to give to a non-elected judiciary. And therefore, it seems to me that since states can still do it, if we really want to protect freedom, then it's protected by the freedoms that we... If we want the federal judiciary to intervene and protect freedom, then it ought to be specific... Then it ought to be those that have decent textual support and not those that they don't. That's my answer. They're really not individual rights. States can still do it. It's only the difference between individual rights and states' rights is individual rights are denial of all power. States' rights only say, well, it's up to the states. They can do whatever they want.
Thank you, Jesse. I want to go to questions. I want to point out or highlight one thing Jesse just said. There is a, believe it or not, there's a systematic difference between the Gun-Free School Zones Act case, that would be Lopez, and the Violence Against Women Act, that would be United States versus Morrison on the one hand, and then the Raich case on the other. And it's this, to my mind. With respect to the Violence Against Women Act, and with respect to the Gun-Free School Zones Act, there is no way that you would get genuine policy competition among the states. It'll all go one way. Most states already have Gun-Free School Zones Act. All states prohibit and, in fact, criminalize violence against women. No state will offer or will compete by offering a less pro-regulatory environment. If anything, all the competition will cut into a pro-regulatory direction. So long as that is the case, the Supreme Court's so-called federalism majority is comfortable with it. Whereas in Raich, when you're talking about medical marijuana, heaven help us, actual political and policy competition might break out among the states. And in fact, in that case, there was a wonderful brief by the state of Alabama, written by Kevin Newsom, saying, there's no way a law like that could be ever passed in Alabama. We are proud of enforcing the marijuana laws, but if they want to have this law, they ought to be allowed to. That was a forceful brief. That's, I think, what the Supreme Court didn't like about it. Policy competition, no way, because that might deprive us up here of our role in superintending the nation's moral conscience, and we can't have that. Questions, please. Sorry, if you could wait for the microphone, please, if we have one. Otherwise, Jim, do me a favor, yell. If you could please wait for the microphone and then identify yourself. Thanks.
Jim Blumstein, Vanderbilt Law School. One interesting fairly recent development in limiting the scope of the Commerce Clause comes up in the antitrust arena that you may be interested in. The Sixth Circuit recently, following on a Third Circuit case, has held that the antitrust laws don't apply to certain non-commercial activities, such as eligibility rules for participating in sports under NCAA, for example. And there's a Supreme Court case that says the antitrust laws were designed to extend to the maximum constitutional power under the Commerce Clause, which would seem very much to cover eligibility rules or anything else, since the Commerce Clause, as we know, is extremely expansive. But in, I think it's the Bassett case, the Sixth Circuit very recently, following on a Third Circuit case, held that it did not apply to eligibility rules, or in that case involving the coach's discipline, and the coach was attempting to raise an antitrust claim. And instead of dismissing it on the antitrust merits, which would have been very easy to do because it was a very strained antitrust claim, the Sixth Circuit, following the Third, just said the antitrust laws don't apply here. So the implication is that there's a constitutional limit, given the earlier Supreme Court case, that the federal government has exercised its maximum authority under the Commerce Clause. The court has basically said that this is non-commercial activity, and the law that's the maximum power of the federal government under the Commerce Clause is inapplicable to these eligibility rules. So I just want to put that on the landscape. That does suggest that that courts are trying to find ways to limit the scope of federal power, and I think ultimately the implication there, if the earlier case is still good law, is that this is beyond Congress's power under the Commerce Clause.
Well, I would comment this way, Jim, about that. This is a case of statutory interpretation. I know you said that the doctrine is that there's no difference between the scope of the statute's reach and constitutional power. I don't think one can fairly read this case, despite what you said, which is a perfectly good argument, as holding that it is beyond Congress's power to regulate eligibility of student-athletes or coaches' conduct under the Commerce Clause. I mean, these are commercial transactions. They reek with commerce, and are they taking it up, this case? My guess is the Supreme Court would deny review because they'll look at it simply as a case of statutory interpretation, and unless there's a conflict, and you said there are two circuits the same way, the Third and the Sixth, no conflict, no review.
I
There is not a conflict at this point, to my knowledge. The earlier case, it was a Summit Health case, that held that the Commerce Clause did extend, and then there's an earlier one, the Rex Hospital case. So there are two earlier Supreme Court cases that said, and in fact, there was dissent and majority were back and forth about it, so it was not just an incident of the opinion. It was a centerpiece of the earlier opinion. Because in those cases were health law cases where the lower courts had held that they, that basically the antitrust law didn't apply to various peer-reviewed decisions about hospital privileges for doctors and so forth. And the dissenters wanted to limit the scope of federal power. The majority ruled that since Congress went to its maximum authority under the Commerce Clause, of course it could cover peer-reviewed decisions because Congress exercised its maximum authority. So they rejected that line of cases where the courts were split on that issue. And now it's coming back here. Now, there is no split. I believe that the Third Circuit case, that John Roberts, when he was practicing law, may have been involved in that case. I don't want to assert that. He was involved in part of that case. I don't know if he was involved in this part of that case. But certainly this is very recent. It's within the last 2 months that the Sixth Circuit has decided this the Bassett case. And so I just throw that out because ultimately the argument really is that this is of constitutional import if you put those two cases together. Now, the Sixth Circuit doesn't ever address this question.
Uh-huh.
And so I think it's a fair issue as to whether, if that were presented to them, whether they would have ruled the same way. But this line of reasoning, the courts are looking for ways to limit the scope of federal law. But if the federal law goes to the maximum of constitutional authority, then they've got to reconcile these problems.
Could I just add to this, for those who don't know this case, the dissent in the earlier Summit Health case was by Justice Scalia, who regarded the majority opinion in that case as just nuts. He might, in fact, welcome hearing that same case again, stare decisis or not. I mean, I'm not predicting that, but this is a very different Supreme Court now from what was it, 1984? Is that it? 1991. Yes.
I'm really loud. I don't think I need that thing. This is for Dean Schober and Randy. I have never understood how someone can say, on the other hand, we don't need the court to protect the states because the states are perfectly well protected through the, and here's the phrase, ordinary political process of Congress. Congress cares about states. And on the other hand, say it's okay for the court to use a plain statement rule to strain in a statute to find that the states are protected. Because it seems to me a plain statement rule that strains against other canons of construction to construe, for instance, in Gregory v. Ashcroft, the phrase, any person, sounds pretty clear to me, to mean no state judge. Any rule like that is presupposing, A, that the political process does not work very well to protect the states, so we need to give Congress a nudge to help them protect the states more. Now, if we need to give them a nudge, why can't we give them a shove?
Well, the answer, my answer, not the answer, my answer would be to assume that Congress knows what all its language means. Even your argument is a perfectly straightforward, logical, good argument. All right. Justice O'Connor, I believe, wrote the Ashcroft against Gregory. Is that right? I think so. And she was a great defender of states' rights. She would say, you really want to do this? You can. I don't believe you really thought this through when you said all employees. You can fool with the word employees. I forget exactly how that works. You know, partners in law firms, this is not my area, partners in law firms are exempt. Maybe judges are like partners in law firms instead of being just the faculty. Or associates in the law firms or what have you. But the big difference to me is the extent to which the court ought to use this awesome power of judicial review to interpret the Constitution. And what it means when I say judicial review interpreting the Constitution means that the court has the final word. That's why the court doesn't have the final word on dormant Commerce Clause cases. They can be overturned, and they have been overturned. I don't say it's easy. I don't say it's easy at all. But if the court were to say, in cases of ambiguity, we value the principles behind federalism, behind the reservation of power to the states, behind the delegated powers theory. You want to do it, you better do it clearly. State interests ought to have a chance to speak up, which I don't think they I don't know the history of that statute, the Age Discrimination Act, but I don't think they really had that in mind at the time. Certain interests were presented. Academics were presented. They got a 9 or 11 year immunity from the statute. Then it expired. It had a sunset provision. So I think there's a big difference. Congress can look. Let me say this: the court holds in the Garcia case that state employees are subject to the wage and hour provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Okay, and that Congress had the power to do it. That's what they said. States and municipalities in particular were very unhappy about this. Why? Because you've got to pay time and a half if you employ someone for more than 40 hours a week. All right? Do you know what happened within months? Within months of that decision, Congress turned around and said, no, it doesn't apply to what's called comp time arrangements for the states, which means we don't pay you time and a half. But we give you comp time off. You could, you know, we can make you work 60 hours this week. You get 20 hours work credit. It happens with some the states really want something. I tell you, they get it. A majority. But if a majority of states look, the greatest issues in the country at the founding. You guys are the founder people. Had to do with competition between between some states and other states. The clearest power given to Congress is the power to impose tariffs. If you don't think that divides that divided the states, you know, I don't know, down the middle, but very seriously, that's it. Congress has the power. States lose. States lose in the process. That's just the way it goes. Similarly, it seems to me that same rationale bodes well. I don't say it's perfect. I don't say they're going to win every time. I certainly don't. They didn't win with the Gun-Free School Zones Act, right? 28 states got the law already. Why didn't they? Because, you know, guns near schools, it's like motherhood and apple pie. You just don't vote against those things, even though they should have, in my judgment. Violence against women is the same sort of thing. No one's in favor of it. And very often Congress will simply respond to, well, if no one's in favor of it, then we got the power to impose it, even though I think there was a lot to be said for saying this is something that the states are separately, with which the states are separately competent to deal, and you don't have a race to the bottom issue or all of those things. Okay? Yeah, I'll leave it with one point. If I were to devise a standard for the issue today, it would be this came from the original Virginia plan. It's been argued a number of times that the criterion ought to be whether the issue that Congress has tackled is one which can be demonstrated that the states can't handle by themselves. All right, not that it affects commerce or something like that. Everything affects commerce, and the court said that's why we have to put a limit on it. That the problem is they put a limit that's very, very malleable, as indicated in Rage.
We will take one more question.
Yeah. Sorry.
I'll change my mind. You've had your chance.
Mr.
Bader in the background.
I was wondering why the Tenth Amendment and the Commerce Clause...
Wait. Whoa. Now...
I was wondering why the Tenth Amendment and the Commerce Clause should be treated similarly for justiciability purposes, given that, as Professor Chopra has observed, the states are very attuned to protect their Tenth Amendment interests in cases like usury, very quickly seeking corrective legislation, whereas in the Commerce Clause context, the states are very happy to have the government overreach its powers under the Commerce Clause, as illustrated by the Lopez case, where Texas was quite happy to let the feds go in and handle what was, in fact, a violation of state law, and the Morrison case, where something like 40 attorneys general basically filed a brief with the Supreme Court saying, yes, 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 let Congress regulate to the broadest extent possible. Let them regulate this area. Given that the states will fight a Tenth Amendment violation through well-funded lobbyists in the Congress, but they seem to roll over and play dead in the context of any Commerce Clause issue where Congress is regulating intrastate private conduct like that involved in Raich, why should we treat Tenth Amendment claims the same as the Commerce Clause claims at issue in Lopez, Morrison, and Raich?
I'm not sure. Did you? I followed you right up to the end of the question.
Because doesn't your theory argue that the Tenth Amendment claims should be that the Commerce Clause should be equally non-justiciable?
With the Tenth Amendment claims should be non-justiciable.
Because Lopez involved a Commerce Clause claim, and Morrison, a Commerce Clause
I think
clause
his
claim.
Point was, and I want to hear your answer to this, is that the states seem to, on your argument, at least on the argument of the question, is that the states are do look after their interests when they were talking about their interests, and to the extent that's a Tenth Amendment claim, that's fine. That could be non-justiciable. But the argument, the question is, with respect to Commerce Clause claims, the states are happy to have the federal government regulate, and so that's where you need justiciability, because the states aren't looking out for federalism in that context. Is that your question?
Exactly.
I guess I would say they're always looking out for their own interests. If they the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which was referred to earlier today, was a question of permitting states to discriminate against interstate insurance companies. The states always have an interest in having the feds come in and regulate activity within their boundaries. They have an interest. Sometimes they're happy. Sometimes they're not happy. When they're really not happy, you hear from them. When they are not unhappy, then my question is, the people who are being regulated by the federal statute have no constitutional, they themselves have no constitutional right to be free of regulation. Their right is only derivative.
But in the Morrison case, the challengers did argue that they had something akin to a right to challenge it. And in the context of the Dormant Commerce Clause, the Supreme Court has said that Section 1983 claims can assert an individual right based on the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is admittedly a slightly different area. But if there can be an individual right fashioned under the Dormant Commerce Clause against regulation, why shouldn't we analogously view a challenge to an invalid regulation beyond Congress's power under the Commerce Clause as also implicating individual rights?
I don't think anyone has an individual right under the Dormant Commerce Clause. We permit challenges. We permit third-party standing, if you will. When an individual company has been regulated by the state, which argues that this is contrary to Congress's unexercised power under the Commerce Clause, what we're doing is permitting that individual to assert the rights of Congress. That's all right with me, because they are not raising a constitutional question. It's just like an issue. It's the same issue that they would raise if they said this state regulation is contrary to a federal statute. They're raising a statutory right. They're not raising any constitutional right here. They raise a constitutional right. But in the end, if Congress doesn't like the decision, they can change it.
Randy, 1 minute.
One of the things that I disagree with Jesse about is that Jesse views the only rights we have as, quote, constitutional rights that are protected, of which he says there's very few. I mean, I think that the rights the rights that are retained by the people are very broad and general. And then there needs to be a justification for interfering with the exercise of those rights. Federalism is not an end in itself. Very few people think it is. Justice O'Connor certainly didn't. Federalism is a means to the end, and the Raich case illustrates how it is a means to the end of the protection of individual liberty, not the kind of fundamental constitutional rights that Jesse would necessarily see protected, but individual liberty nonetheless, real liberty, liberty of actual real people to preserve their life, avoid needless pain and suffering, etc. The last thing I just want to mention, because it's been said several times, has to do with what Jesse said, talked about the malleability of the doctrine. The doctrine was not in the Commerce Clause area. It was not that malleable. It was made malleable, but like anything could be made malleable. It actually was reasonably straightforward. The lesson that you should take away from this, I've already given you the three federalisms. Here's another lesson I really want you to take away from this. Most of the expansion that's been done in this area is done under the rubric of the Necessary and Proper Clause. It's not done under the rubric of the Commerce Clause. The secret to Justice Scalia's concurring opinion in Raich was a Necessary and Proper Clause opinion exclusively. What he argued was that under an exception, a doctrinal exception in Lopez, Congress had the power to reach non-economic activity, which he said this was. Not that the non-economic line was so fuzzy you couldn't tell. He said it was non-economic activity, but Congress may reach it if it is essential to the preservation or the efficacy of a broad national regulatory scheme, which was, in fact, something that was Chief Justice Rehnquist mentioned in Lopez. We conceded that exception to the economic-non-economic distinction in oral argument. We conceded that. However, and here is the secret to Justice Scalia's outcome. He then said that what is or is not essential to a broader regulatory scheme is a matter to be handled by pure rational basis scrutiny. In other words, we are not going to ask the government to come forward and justify its claim that the reaching of this conduct is essential to a broader regulatory scheme. We were happy if we could get a hearing on whether it was essential to a broader regulatory scheme to reach this local backyard activity. But Justice Scalia, I think, had a framework that was okay. But then by using an extremely deferential approach to what was essential to a broader regulatory scheme, that's how he reached the result he did. Again, it's all Necessary and Proper Clause. None of this is Commerce Clause.
It is necessary and proper that we end this riveting discussion now. We'll have a very brief break and then go out for dinner, so to speak. Please join me in thanking Dean Schoeffer and Franny Barnett.